So, good morning. Welcome to Go Ahead's half-year results for 2014-15. In normal format, I'll just take you through a summary. Keith will take through the numbers. I'll come back and put a bit more color on some of those numbers, and then we'll have a Q&A afterwards. I gather we've got quite a lot of people dialing in at the moment because it's half term, so there's a lot of people at home in their pajamas listening to. So overall, our results are in line with our expectations. Full-year expectations are unchanged. Bus operating profit up 8.4% to 45.1 million, and that's in line with our strategic target. Rail operating profit down 2.9% to 10.2 million, and our margins are reduced to 0.9%. Our contribution, this is quite important, our contribution to government has increased to 108.2 million pounds. It's been a challenging start to the GTR franchise, we have to admit. Our investment is already underway to improve performance for passengers over and above the plans that are already in place. We're working with Network Rail to minimize the disruption that have been caused to rail passengers during the infrastructure projects, in particular, obviously, the London Bridge 6.5 billion pound Thames Link investment program. And our proposed interim dividend is increased by 4.3% to 26.6, and that's in line with our 2013-14 dividend increase. We've been shortlisted for the Northern and TPE TransPennine Express franchises, and as I'll explore later, we are exploring bus and rail opportunities abroad. Strong cash flow, reduction in adjusted net debt. So with that, I'll ask Keith to take you through the numbers.
Thank you, David. So in summary, as David said, overall in line with expectations, good performance across all business units, and I'll obviously talk about those individually. Just a slight note around just a small restatement of the prior year numbers. This is the prior year restatement of a last year's comparative where we adjusted by 2 million on a full-year basis in September, so there's nothing unusual in this. It's worth also remembering that we have an IAS 19 impact of 12.1 million pounds. I think it's worth reminding, particularly from the fact it's non-cash and gets added back in the cash flow, and also because we take that into account when we consider our dividend policy and our dividend cover calculation. So overall, group revenue was up 13.8%, 10% of which had come from GTR. Again, I will talk about that in a little bit more detail later. And overall operating profit up 6.1%. So moving through the businesses, looking at regional bus to begin with, revenue up 4.1%. As we've been saying during the course of the year, some of that has been due to contract revenue growth without associated journeys, and which also will involve as well some incremental cost as well, and also high yield fares. We have seen a passenger journey decrease of 0.5%. David will talk a little bit more about the North East and Oxford and specific issues there, but when you add those, exclude those, we've actually got an underlying growth of 1.7%, which is much more in line with our historic average. We've seen commercial and concessionary revenue growth across all our businesses. It is worth remembering as well that 60% of commercial revenue is fixed, so although we've seen some decline in concessionary journeys in line with overall passenger journeys, this fixed element means revenue isn't greatly as impacted and also partly explains the gap between passenger journeys and revenue growth. Seeing a small increase in mileage year on year, again reflecting the contract gains, and we are expecting a lower revenue growth in the second half of the year as we lap some of those contract gains as well. Looking in a bit more detail at the profit bridge, operating profit in regional was up to 23.4 million, with the key story really being beneficial cost movements, particularly in insurance, where we've again continued to focus on accident prevention and claim management. In fuel, we've seen a lower hedge price this year, and also on pensions, where we've seen a reduction in defined benefit charges. This time last year, we actually had a one-off non-recurring incentive when we closed the scheme, but then that benefit is partially offset by the fact we've replaced that with a DC scheme and also have auto-enrollment that's coming in as well. Organic growth reflects, as you say, the revenue, less cost inflation, and also the cost associated with the contract gains. But overall, H1 margins again improved year on year, to 12.9%, and in line with the trajectory that we would be requiring as part of the £100 million target. Also, just to point out, in this profit bridge, we've included cost of Singapore, so we have bid for a Singapore contract, £0.7 million in the first half of the year, expected to be £1 million in total, because it straddled Christmas. We submitted the bid in January, and David will talk more about this later in his section. Having a look at London Bus in more detail, again, very consistent story. We saw revenue growth at 2.8%. We have this reallocation of BSOG from cost to revenue that's contributed 2.6%. So underlying revenue growth more or less flat, reflecting like-for-like mileage being down by 1.6%, as we expected in the first half of the year due to contract losses. Although we do expect to largely regain that contract mileage in the second half of the year. So in line with expectations, Quicks slightly down in the first half. So again, looking at that from a profit bridge perspective, a very similar story, an increase in operating profit up to 21.7. We've seen the benefits, same benefits have come through regional bus on fuel, insurance and pensions. The only difference here, obviously, underlying growth being negative, reflecting the loss in contract mileage. But overall margins, again, as we've been saying for several years now, generally relatively stable at around the 9.5% mark and consistent overall. Just looking at fuel, just to remind that we were fully hedged this year at 4% lower than last year, hence the saving on our fuel costs. We've already fully hedged for FY16 at a further 5.6% lower. And then from F17 onwards, we're now in line with our existing hedge policy, so we're building towards to be 50% hedged by the end of this year, and 25% for FY17 and 25% for FY18. That means we don't see the benefit of current low oil price until FY17, July 16, to be more accurate. And again, just reminding ourselves that since we've had that reallocation of BSOG from cost to contract revenue in London, our the amount that we receive from BSOG is around £20 million in our regional businesses. Moving on to rail. Again, fairly consistent story here. Southern, we've seen revenue growth driven by good journey numbers. We're still in revenue support in Southern, and we will be until we integrate that franchise into GTR in July. In South Eastern, we've seen a strong start to that franchise with revenue growth over 10%. We're now operating under new contract terms, and because that growth was more than we were anticipating at the beginning of the direct award, we've actually made profit share contributions and expect to make profit share contributions in the first half of the year. As far as London Midland is concerned, again, fairly consistent performance, slightly lower this year, particularly impacted by trading some engineering work in the first quarter. GTR, that began trading in September. We've actually highlighted the revenue and journey numbers here because as a franchise, we're still responsible for generating and collecting passenger revenue. So I think it's important that we still continue to report numbers as with other franchises. And as you can see from the revenue and passenger growth, we're seeing good growth on that network. Having said that, as David alluded to, some investment in GTR improvements and our improvement plan resulted in no contribution to group profits in the first half of the year. Although we hope that that will be, expect that will be temporary. And then again, just a reminder, our fare increase in January will be slightly lower than this time last year, so you would expect a small reduction in yields. Breaking profit down in a little bit more detail, so operating profit overall is slightly down. We saw passenger revenue increase by 29.1%, which includes £175 million for GTR. So the way that we're looking at that is we'll include the passenger revenue of 175, and if you look in the analysis of our revenue notes, we then pay over what we call a GTR revenue adjustment of around £47 million to get down to the franchise payment which is our payment for that contract. But overall, as David said, including all premiums, subsidies, revenue support, profit shares, and this GTR revenue adjustment, our net contribution increased by 85 million to 108 million. Margins at historically low levels at below 1%. As far as bid costs are concerned, we're going to talk again a little bit more about Germany. We're going to spend about 1.5 million on our German bid costs this year as part of now a 9 million total bid costs. But it's worth remembering that both Germany and Singapore bid costs are reflected in management expectations. And again, just as a reminder, we have capitalized, as expected, around 3 million of mobilization costs on GTR. So as far as the summary income statement is concerned, operating profits in line, net finance costs similar to last year, FY15 tax rate in line with expectations at around 22%. We've seen adjusted earnings per share at 75.6. We had a benefit last year of the deferred tax, a lower tax rate that impacted us, helped us by 15.6 last year. So when you strip that out, we've seen good EPS growth, and we have increased the dividend to 4.3%. Just looking at cash, some significant movements here on working capital in particular. So we saw an incremental, an extra 40 million pound of working capital inflow from GTR. This was over and above the transfer in of season ticket monies that we were expecting of around 40 million. And we probably don't expect this to reverse. This should be a permanent. But we have seen big increases, as we normally see at this time of year, in season ticket monies in December. And also a couple of timing of big contractual payments, some of which of that will reverse. So we would expect about 70 million of that working capital benefit to reverse in the second half of the year. And it is also worth pointing out that all of the positive working capital movement is actually included within restricted cash. So free cash flow significantly up on last year due to the positive working capital, but also obviously improved profitability and lower capital expenditure this year compared to last year. So bus CapEx, 14 million, still expecting 40 million on a full year basis in line with original expectations. And rail, slightly less to begin with, 2 million, but still expecting 20 million, albeit slightly lower than 25 million that we were originally expecting. Also worth pointing out in this cash flow that you can see is a 10 million pound add-back for pensions, which reflects, as I say, the non-cash IAS 19 movement. So moving on to the balance sheet. So adding back the restricted cash, our adjusted net debt to EBITDA 1.47 below our target range. As you can see, the restricted cash increased very significantly in line with rail working capital. We had a net cash balance of 169 million. When you consider the 70 million pound that we expect to reverse on working capital, then we would expect net cash at the end of the year to be around 100 million. And then finally, just a quick catch-up on pensions. Overall, a reduction in the pension accounting deficit, which is good news. Different assumptions are applied on actuarial valuation compared to the accounting valuation. We did close the scheme as we outlined in April 2014. But with that, I'll now hand you back to David.
Thank you, Keith. To start off with, I'll take you through regional bus. Remember, we call it regional bus now. Operating profit up 13%, margins improving, which is what we expected, up to 12.9%. And as we planned, the regional bus profitability has overtaken London's profitability. We always said we needed to achieve to do that to achieve the 100 million pound target, and that was our growth assumption for regional bus. We're still committed and on target to our 100 million pound target for FY 2015-16. Keith said I'll talk a bit more about the Northeast economy. Basically, it's recovering at a much slower rate than elsewhere in the U.K., and that's impacting passenger numbers. One statistic is the fact that unemployment there is 8.5% versus 5.8% in the rest of the U.K. This less economic activity just leads to less discretionary travel taking place. In Oxford, we've had some significant roadworks resulting in long delays, congestion, and deterring people from traveling. The background to that is the County Council has received a lot of money for road work infrastructure improvements. So in the long term, that will lead to economic growth. But in the meantime, we have to put up with this continual congestion and disruption that's taken place on a progressive basis across Oxford. The upside is actually that passengers have come back to us. So we've had one chunk of it and passengers have returned. We launch our new bus app next week to make bus travel more convenient for our passengers. It's building on our existing m-ticketing channels and experience with the rail app. 235,000 people are now using m-ticketing channels. And in the next week on our app, we'll have ticket gifting, ping it as a payment option, and Twitter updates and everything you could possibly want. And Oxford is actually 100% Wi-Fi. And these are all the sorts of reasons why we get people come back to us and actually join us in the first place. We're introducing at a first stage of a multi-operator ticketing, smart ticketing scheme in the northeast, giving passengers more choice and flexibility. It's the first part of our commitment in Tyne and Wear to multi-operator ticketing. It's being led by the operators. And we, as Go Ahead, are still the largest user of smart cards outside of London, with 600,000 users of our smart card. We continue to invest in the fleet. We think that's very important, £10 million again in the period. There'll be more in the second half. That's all about having the right approach, and that's about sustainable profits. And we continue to look at all the cost savings we can. We never let up on that. We go round and round trying to find more cost savings. Just talking about the general market and what's happening in that. Tyne and Wear are still looking to introduce a quality contract scheme, and bus franchising is being considered in Manchester. We have a devolved structure. We get why people would want localism. We may not agree with what they're trying to do, but we do get why they're trying to do it. In terms of the quality contract scheme in Newcastle, there's a further delay to it whilst they do further work on it. So this is now the fourth iteration of their quality contract scheme. But even so, it will still not happen until late summer now, 2017 at the earliest. We do positively and passionately believe in voluntary partnerships, which will provide a better outcome for both bus passengers and taxpayers. It's always been about partnerships. It's never anything different. We need local authorities to deliver on the infrastructure, such as bus lanes, and they get us to deliver their policies. So, for instance, in January of this year, a low emission zone was introduced in Brighton. That's what the local authority wanted, and it came at no cost. We put the hybrid buses in, so they have their policies, and we deliver for them. And in the end, I've yet to meet a local authority where we don't have the same aligned outcomes. We both want more passengers. We both want more bus passengers, and that's a good place to be. So what do we bring to the party in terms of Go Ahead? Investment to start off with. Both in buses, premises and technology, £170 million over the last 5 years. Local authorities can only get that level of capital investment by either increasing fares, looking at borrowing on future revenues or central government grants. That's what happens in London, but we invest out of our profits. We're responsive. We listen to customers' needs and respond to them. Bus passenger satisfaction rates are at 92%. We have to listen to our customers. That's why we exist. And often our biggest detractors on bus are people who actually don't use the service. Growing patronage, that's what we've been doing. That's what we're doing with good local authorities. We've been doing that. Passenger journeys are up 15% over the last 5 years. And that's by a combination of measures. But in the end, it's focusing on what customers want, which is reliability, punctuality and frequency. Community, we're an integral part of our local communities. Wherever we operate, we are part of the local community. Which we serve. Our people come from that community. We're part of it in every aspect. Our buses are local markets. Smart ticketing, largest user of smart cards outside of London, which I've already said. We continue to invest in what the next technology would look to be, and we're at the forefront of operator-led schemes such as in Nexus, in the Tyne and Wear, and in Oxford with Transform. And adaptability. We work in partnership. That's part of our DNA at Go Ahead, is working in partnership with all our stakeholders. And our belief, it's not going to be the strong or the smart that survive, but the most adaptable that will survive in a changing political world. Moving to London Bus, well-established, regulated market. It's a very consistent theme, very, very predictable in many ways. We are the largest operator with 24% of the services. We are best in class with the best operating margins of 9.5%. Good quality, experienced team, high contract retention rate. A lot of roadworks and congestion. Many of them are about regeneration. Places like Lewisham, where we operate, and Elephant Castle, where we operate, they're regeneration schemes which cause a lot of disruption. And they're part of the growing pains of a growing city, basically. In the end, they enable us to have more economic growth, but we work very closely with TfL in the meantime to actually find ways of mitigating that congestion. But it has, in the last quarter for us, been some of the worst congestion for some time. Population growth, they're both of these things are linked together. Increasing demand, there's 1 million people who've joined our city over the last 10 years. It's a city the size of Birmingham. I don't think they've all come from Birmingham, but it's now 8.6 million, and that surpasses the peak that was previously set in 1939. And I just hark back to, in 2007, I was working for Ken Livingstone and produced a plan for him about how do you expand buses in London, because we were projecting population growth to 8.3 million. Way gone beyond that. And so TfL are doing the same things. Population growth is in the suburbs. Two-thirds of all buses in London operate in the suburbs. So the current incumbent is looking at the same thing of how do we get more buses in to serve that population. So they have plans for 500 extra buses to be introduced, which will provide additional capacity of 2.9 million journeys per week. Moving to rail. Starting with South Eastern, Keith's mentioned strong trading performance. New contract started in October 2014. We've contributed to DfT through a profit share mechanism. And we have actually delivered successfully timetable changes that came in on the 12th of January, post the London Bridge works that took place over Christmas. And just to put some context to some of those works, the industry, because it's not us on its own, the industry, Network Rail, the DfT infrastructure plans, closed two of the busiest platforms in the whole of Europe, platforms 5 and 6. They serve 93,000 people every single day. And simultaneously, we changed the travel patterns of these people that have been set in stone for decades now. We did all of that. We did it working with the travel demand management team that led the Olympics. So we've been working with DfT, working with TfL, working with London Travel Watch to communicate all these changes. But obviously, you're not going to have it smooth running from day one. We've gone through some of those difficulties, and we're progressively getting better at the moment. The timetable change that's gone in has meant that our performance on South Eastern in public performance measures is actually reaching into the 90s on a regular basis at the moment. So there is a steady improvement taking place. We're working very hard with all the various partners that I've just outlined to minimize that disruption, and working very hard with Network Rail, particularly at a local level, to have operational improvements in terms of their infrastructure. Moving on to Southern, trading again in line with expectations. They have the same stories about London Bridge. It's a different type of story. Their story, though, is about capacity constraints created from the infrastructure improvements at London Bridge. We actually plan to serve the station with more trains than we're currently able to. So we can only fit in 20 in the evening peak. That obviously creates a lot of problems in terms of capacity on our trains and what we've had to do to deal with that. And what you actually get with London Bridge is a domino effect of the capacity constraints, and it's a domino effect across the whole of the network. We run very, very tight timetables, and it only requires a few delays of minutes at London Bridge to have a domino effect across the whole of the network. And that's what we're dealing with at the moment with Network Rail. That's where we're trying to get the improvement in performance, and that's where we're trying to find out from Network Rail what do we think the capacity of London Bridge can actually cater for going forward. We've continued with the key, which is our smart card in Southern, and we've got 50,000 of those issued. Work is underway to integrate Southern with the GTR franchise, Southern and Gatwick Express, in July of this year. That actually is a big task. It shouldn't be underestimated. It's almost as big as taking over GTR in the first place, just in terms of some of the computer links you've got to do. But it's actually really, from our point of view, it's about organizational design and organizational structures as well, and merging of two organizations. London Midland, revenue and journey growth, as Keith has said, has been slow due to the engineering work in the first quarter, but the franchise has continued to improve. It's been the best for over 2 years at the moment. We've had problems 2 years ago. We've put them right, and we've had some really good performance figures of late, Birmingham City, the cross-city links in Birmingham have been particularly good, for example. We've introduced 40 new train carriages, increasing capacity and frequency, and working with DfT for a planned extension through to June 2017 as a DAC. On to GTR. We were chosen to run the UK's biggest train franchise. We were chosen because we were the ones that could deliver this in terms of the £6.5 billion Thameslink programme, and we were chosen because we were the ones who would work collaboratively with all the partners that would help deliver it. This began in September. We had a very short mobilisation period. It was, and we outlined this at the Rail Industry Day last October, creation of a new business. It's a new leadership team. It's a new culture. A programme of works for customer improvements were put in. However, during the period, we've had significant disruption, and that will continue into the second half of this year. And those have all been about infrastructure issues and about inherited operational challenges that we've had. So we've had the infrastructure issues, which are about capacity, which I've just explained for Southern. They've also affected GTR. And we've had Thames water flooding at Farringdon. That impacted our operations for over 6 days. And it meant our inability to provide a proper service for that during that period of time. But worse than that, it actually also affected 17 engines of 17 trains. And we're still living with the legacy of that as we try to fix the problems that the floodwater created. And we've had operational issues as well. We require investment in drivers, more drivers than we anticipated. We need to invest in getting more training, more maintenance, more rolling stock. We bid on information provided in summer 2013. I've been talking to DfT this week, and they recognise also that when you start a franchise, the information, at the very start of the franchise, the information is already 3 years out of date for them as it is for us. Passenger numbers change, performance changes. You know when you've started that the bid is going to be wrong almost, and it's about how you manage all of that. One of the issues we've had is finding that we didn't have enough drivers for actually dealing with some of the training requirements that we needed and actually going forward into the contract. Our issue is that you cannot start investing and recruiting more drivers until you're actually in charge of the operation. So we came in September, we started, the good side is we've identified this very early and we're getting on with managing that problem. But what happens on the rail side is it takes 12 to 15 months to actually train a driver. So it's going to take quite a long time for that to work through the system. But we've already got all our plans in place. We've already got the driving schools up and running to full scale. And that will come progressively good over the course of the year. We have introduced an improvement plan with Network Rail to address a lot of these issues. That's about accelerating the overall plan, looking to increase the rolling stock provision. Some of it will be on a temporary basis, albeit maybe for a couple of years, and provide some more resilience on the assets from Network Rail. DfT are absolutely behind us on this. They understand the scale of the problems. They're very, very supportive. They understand the issues that we're facing, and we're working with them and Network Rail to actually get the improvements. So the incremental costs, and Keith said this should be temporary, because performance will improve. Increased infrastructure investment, it's essential to improve services. It's all about delivering the long term. It's all about investment now because of this growing population in the city, about serving that population. And you have to invest and you have to put these infrastructure improvements in place. I've said this before, but it is a bit like doing open heart surgery on a marathon runner. We're doing all this whilst keeping the operation running. So ultimately, it will increase passenger capacity by 50%. We will introduce three more train fleets, and it will create quicker and more reliable journeys. And that's what we have to hang on to, and we're progressively moving towards improvements in the performance. Keith also said I'll talk about where we've been looking for other opportunities. We've always considered growth prospects, both within and outside of our traditional markets. We are completely focused on the UK market, but we look to see where we can have other value-adding opportunities in line with a very measured approach to risk. So the bid team are at the moment at the home market preparing bids for Northern and TransPennine ITT. They're due out in late February. There's no reason why they shouldn't be out on time. And there are other rail opportunities in the programme for us to consider as well. We have submitted a bid for the contractor for a bus contract in Singapore. Very, very similar features to the London bus market. to the extent that they are operating a sort of quality incentive contract regime. Funnily enough, it was something I was involved in writing and introducing and monitoring, and have given them large amounts of advice on it as well. They came over to see us in London, they visited our bus depots, and we've had long discussions with them about that. The first tranche is 380 buses, and there's other tranches to follow. So it's a substantial amount of business to get in on the first time. There will be a lot of competition, but there are low capex requirements, both in terms of buses and property, because we'll be leasing them. It's a billion passenger journeys annually type business, and it's a good place to do work. It's a stable economy, it's a growing economy, there's a growing population, and it's very welcoming as well, which is good. We've also set up a small team in Germany, a small office in Berlin. They're considering opportunities in the regional rail market there. Again, that was a very considered approach as to go into Germany. It's a very stable and growing economy. It's the largest European rail market, in fact, and it's very regionalised. The contracting authority is the regional government, and there are 26 separate tendering authorities, all with their unique characteristics, which gives us opportunities to bid in those different areas. And it's actually very low bid costs. These franchises are much lower volume than the ones that we expect and that come out in the UK. The bid costs are much lower accordingly. So regional passenger revenue, 9.6 billion, 50 billion annual passenger kilometres operated. It's a big market. So we consider these opportunities, careful analysis, and we look to places where we think we can have similar characteristics and apply our skill set that we use in the UK. So in summary, our overall expectations remain unchanged. We expect similar second half profits as the first half, both in bus and rail. We remain committed to our £100 million bus operating profit target. In rail, we're concentrating on delivering operational improvements and successfully integrating Southern and Gatwick Express into GTR in July of next year. We're working on our UK rail bids, considering other opportunities for growth abroad, both in bus and rail. We, the group, remain in good financial position, strong cash generation, robust balance sheet, supporting a progressive dividend policy, allowing flexibility to pursue value-adding opportunities. Thank you very much for listening, and we welcome a Q&A session next. Hold on a minute, let me sit down.
Good morning, it's Edward Stanford from Lazarus. Could I possibly, and presumably inevitably, turn to GTR to start with? Could you just perhaps give an indication the extent to which the current franchise operation is adrift from your bid, and the extent to which the costs will be above expectations to deliver the plan? And I have vague memories of London Midland starting off badly when you first got it. How can you reassure us that this isn't another London Midland?
I'm going to do the first part and do the second part.
Yeah, so from a GTR perspective, I think we gave some outline numbers for passenger revenue and a margin. We suggested probably a profitability of around sort of £10-11 million for the 9 months, 9 to 10 months that we'd be operating. So if you sort of prorated that, you're looking at probably £3-4 million of profit in the first half of the year that we ended up reinvesting back into the business. So we do expect some of that to continue in the second half of the year, but we still expect to make some profits in GTR. We'd expect it to be temporary, and then we'd expect to get back on track with our bid going through into next year, having successfully integrated Southern and then into future years.
And in terms of, neither of us were around when London Midland started. I imagine it'd be the same issue. There are so many moving parts in some of these franchises that you know you're going to get something wrong. It's about how you balance that going forward and with the upsides and the downsides. The two things aren't necessarily related. So it did start off in London Midland with some assumptions that were incorrect. The issue we dealt with as a management team were the operational issues which grew up over time because there was a lack of investment in drivers and driver training.
and that's what we've put right. So we've put right one particular aspect. It wasn't necessarily the same aspect that started off as being a problem in the first place. That's actually what's going on. And we will put this right. When any issues, we will address them and we will put them right.
Hi, it's James Hollins from Nomura. Just following up on the international side, can you perhaps give a bit more detail on the timing of the Singapore bid contract, as well as maybe a guide on what sort of quantum of contribution it might make, contract lengths, etc., in that region? And then just as an adjunct, you've clearly flagged Singapore and Germany. Are there any other countries you're looking at or particular regions, or should we think about only those two in terms of your investment? Thanks.
Thank you. We've just submitted the bid for Singapore at the back end of January. There are 11 other bidders, I'm told. So they do have a long process to go through of actually establishing how they get to a preferred bidder stage or whatever they're going to do. I don't expect to hear from that for another couple of months, at least another 3 months. It becomes operational in 2016, but you start some of the work in 2015. So you start taking over the depot in 2015, which they're building at the moment. So it's 2016 for operational. In terms of scale, there's a number of different tranches coming up. So as I said, there's the first one is 380 buses, and there's further tranches leading up to a total, I think, of 1,000 buses in total by the time we've finished. And the first tranche is worth £70 million of in
revenue.
Of revenue, and what we'll be looking at is a reasonable margin on that amount. We don't. One of the things to make clear is we don't do it strategically. It's a euphemism for flag planting and not making profits. We actually go in to actually make a profit and make a return for our shareholders, and that's what we'll be trying to do with this as well.
Should we assume maybe around the London margins? You said it's got similar sort of structure.
It's a very, very similar structure. It actually, in some respects, is less risk because we won't take ownership of buses and property. So it's actually less risk than in London from that point of view. It's further away, but it depends on whether you count that as being a risky thing or not. We'd use a combination of local people and our own London team, which we've already identified who would go out there.
And the duration is the same as London, so it's 5 years with a potential for a two-year extension.
And in terms of Germany and other places, we are going through a process of now of doing what we did with Germany. We arrived at Germany as being the right place to look at. There are some other markets that we're looking at as well. We won't have a scattergun approach, that's for sure. It will be a very considered approach in terms of how we go to overseas. And we set out how much we're going to bid, over what period of time we're going to bid, and we will stick to those plans. Thank you.
Hello, it's Joe Thomas from HSBT. Just coming back to the GTR issue, perhaps you could just clear up why it's just a temporary impact on profits there before getting back on track. It feels like it's a longer term cost that you're going to be dealing with there. Secondly, on the also inevitable issue of quality contracts and franchising. Can you just give us a sense about what the conversations are that you are having outside of Tyne and Wear? And then finally, with respect back on rail again, thinking about RPI and its collapse and the collapse in inflation this year, how are you building that into your expectations for next year, and how should we think about the impact that could have on profitability, given that wages are still growing?
As far as GTR is concerned, obviously, from a cost perspective, we've been having to train drivers that we weren't expecting, and once those drivers are trained, we should have the right establishment, and we would have forecast the correct establishment, so that should be in our bid model. And similarly on the train side, we'd have assumed that we were going to take on a certain amount of trains to run the timetable that we inherited, and we didn't have enough. So we've had to get in rolling stock at short notice. And then the other problem is maintenance as well. We were probably expecting to do less maintenance on the trains that we took over. So again, we've had to do catch-up So this is all about catching up, really. And then the view on that would be this, that after a period of time, we'd be back in kilter with our bid model, because in December 15 we launch a new timetable, which requires X number of trains, and X number of drivers, and we should be back on track.
In terms of the quality contracts, the quality contract scheme in Tyne and Wear has been going on for years now. We are on it, in many respects, we're on it, the fourth iteration of that. It's just a little bit about the process. The process is that the Nexus have asked for a further delay. It was due to go to a quality contract board in March. They're looking for some delay to that whilst they do more work on the scheme. They were never expected to give an opinion, because that's all they can do, the quality contract board, is give an opinion until the end of May. That may be now put back. All things being equal, what happens after that will still require a public procurement process, a consultation process, and nothing can happen until late summer 2017 unless there's any further delays. So that's, and we're obviously in the middle of all of that, because it's where we operate our buses, so we're very closely involved in everything that's going on. In terms of franchising in Manchester, that was an initiative linked in with devolution, linked in with if you introduce a mayor, various other conditions attached to it, and if you have the right governance in place, which is a catch-all sort of title, then part of that package would be potential for franchising of the bus services. The PTE in Manchester is saying that actually we're quite happy with the buses that we've got, we just want something different, which is a slightly different story that we get from Nexus. We're not so heavily involved because obviously we don't operate buses in Manchester, but we are heavily involved in talking to politicians, and what we'd like to do is be part of the working with the industry to work out what would that franchising look like and under what circumstances would it actually happen. The question is, does it go further than that? And I can't answer that, apart from saying that in all the areas that I operate, all of the local authorities are happy with our bus services. There's not one expression of dissatisfaction, excluding Nexus. There's not one expression of dissatisfaction in terms of where we operate buses. They get what we give them. We've got good working partnerships. There's no rational reason why that should change going forward. And we'll see what happens in other markets, which may lead to other opportunities. And the last one was about RPI, wasn't it?
Deflation, yeah. I mean, as far as inflation is concerned, we have inflation risk or cost versus inflation risk all the time. So whether it's on rail, where you get inflationary increases, for example, on our franchise payments, or even in bus, where we get contract price adjustments, we're always dealing with understanding how our revenue increases versus how our cost increases. So that this is nothing new. It's slightly a different environment because you have deflation, and as you quite rightly say, you're unlikely to reduce wages. But as a business, we'll just have to be more flexible and try and find ways of saving costs to mitigate that. And all of the local the management in those companies understand exactly that's how the model works. Okay. But it's a risk that's just there always.
A good example would be that there's a CPA mechanism in London for London buses, which is based on an average wages index, because you could only get an average wage index for the whole of the UK. Ever since it was introduced, and again, I was involved in doing all this many, many years ago, it has never reflected what's actually happening in London in terms of wage inflation. Never, ever reflected it. So you're always off the mark. You always have been. So you have to make it up in other ways. And it's just about managing the circumstances that you're in. Thanks.
Hello. Jolyon Wellington from JP Morgan. Just following on to that, on the bus contracts, bus business, just in terms of taking out costs, clearly you've taken some out already. I'm just wondering how much further you can take that. Secondly, on the rail business, can I just ask what proportion of the GTR contract is, and sort of, I guess, new southern part, is performance related? And then thirdly, on cash, uses of cash, you said that you expect to be net cash at year end, notwithstanding that part of that is restricted. I think you are below your leverage target. I just wondered what your thoughts are about uses of that cash.
Costs
taking out costs, it's an iterative process, and I've said that before. There isn't one item that would ever actually... There's no one silver bullet in terms of costs. You go around on an iterative basis and look to see where you can keep finding different ways of taking cost out. We operate a Better Together type forums, and the whole purpose of the Better Together forums across our businesses is either to find ways of improving revenue, increasing the number of passengers, what's the best marketing techniques, what's the best technology techniques, what's all the things you can do there. And at the other end, it's about how do you share best practice in terms of taking cost out. I mean, there is a whole range of things going on. We're introducing the next stage of a store system, basically, that will give us better cost control over individual parts, that will give us better warranty claims. Now, all of that, it's real minutiae stuff. But if you're better at your warranty claims, it's just saving money all the time. And if it's 50K in one company and another in another, then that all adds up. It's the aggregation of marginal benefits. And that's what we do all the time. And once you've finished it, you just go round the loop again and see if there's some other cost savings you can get out. And we've been doing that constantly now. And actually, there's always more. That's the amazing thing. There is always more. And you just find different costs to take out.
I mean, as far as performance is concerned, and I think that the question is about penalties for performance, poor performance, perhaps. Okay, so, I mean, obviously for Southern at the minute, until it joins GTR, we have performance targets, but we don't have a performance penalty regime. However, once that gets integrated into GTR, and then GTR currently today, as I said at the Rail Investor Day, we have very similar performance regimes, but they do have the potential for bonus and penalty included within them. And they're things like ticketless travel, which we should be able to control, the normal rail type regimes such as cancellations, delays, Tokon Self delays, capacity, short formations. And those three in particular, they're based on fault attribution. So if it's our fault, you know, that you could end up with a penalty, and we're measured against the things that are our fault. So it's not automatically obvious that if there's very poor performance, that will be attributed to us, and therefore we can expect a penalty. The other point to make is that they're MAAs, so they build up over time, so it's quite difficult to forecast. And that the only one that is slightly different is that we have a new metric, which is called customer experience. And that will be directly related to customer experience. And that one, the customer doesn't care whose fault it is. And that is an area where I think we could be a little bit exposed. But our bid assumed that we would end up in a neutral position with neither a bonus nor a penalty. We'd be net neutral. And currently, we don't believe that has changed. But obviously, that's something we need to track over the next 12 months. But if we put all the performance... all the investment in performance actually improves those metrics, then that should help us in terms of that performance penalties. And then as far as the net cash is concerned of the dividend, yes, we're starting to edge down below our target leverage. We've increased our dividend on a sort of underlying basis. We'll see where we get to at the end of the year. We'll review our dividend cover policy at the end of the year. Clearly, if GTR and Southeastern carry on being successful and reach the targets that they generate, that will generate more cash, but that's still a reasonable way away. We'd probably need to wait to see how those franchises developed. So, we've got our dividend cover policy, and we'll review that again at the end of the year.
Peter Larkin from UBS. Just following on that cash question, is there any situation where you need to keep cash aside on the basis that if you were to potentially win one of the German rail contracts, they can be quite capex heavy in terms of being front end loaded? Do you need to keep like a little bit of a war chest there for that eventuality or not?
The way those contracts work is that you end up going through a procurement process where you enter into a guarantee for a period of time, but then it ends up being leased. So it's actually very similar to the UK model. That's the way that model should work. So you don't actually commit cash. You do give a guarantee for the period of production, but that is a short period of time. And then it gets taken on by a finance institution, and then it becomes a lease, which should transcend the franchise in the same way as it does in the UK. So I think Damien's probably next.
Damien Burrough from Royal Bank of Canada. Two questions, please. First of all, on the regional bus side, outside Oxford and the northeast, where you got the 1.7% growth, do you have any feel of how much that came from your sort of CRM initiatives you've talked about historically, and whether that's changed the sort of peak-off-peak profile of the business? And also sort of related to buses, sort of, I guess the same question, but you know, as motoring costs fall, we're seeing people starting to drive a bit more, but we're not building the road space for that. How are you thinking about sort of benefiting in future from the road congestion that's going to come from that in terms of lifting those CRM initiatives further? And then just a sort of second, more broad question. The Labour Party sounding ever more sort of statist in 1970s on transport. For example, blaming the disruption we saw recently in the private sector when most of it seems to fall on a state-owned entity. How do you prepare yourselves to deal, if you have to, with a sort of transport policy that seems sort of as manoeuvring back to what we had before in the British Rail days as you can with the tools you've got?
Okay, thanks. CRM, customer relationship management, or ECRM as we also call it, because we're doing it all through emails. We do that on a regular basis. We just actually introduced a better database for dealing with that and some more people that are dealing with that. Off the top of my head, I've got to be honest, I can't remember how much that contributes. It contributes, but I couldn't disaggregate that sitting here at the moment. I'd have to go hunting around some figures unless you've got it on your head.
No, I think the biggest contribution is around smart card usage. That's just a means of communicating, but the smart card usage that we've got will definitely drive passenger journeys on a more regular basis, and consistently over the last few years we've seen probably reduced yield, and we've talked about that before around people having a fixed revenue smart card and then using the journeys more often, and maybe the yield slightly reducing, and I think that's still very prevalent.
I mean, people often, you know, I hear lots of people say to me, but you don't have carnets. Well, we do have carnets. We have them on the smart cards, and that encourages people to travel who are infrequent travellers. And Keith's right, you get some yield issues, but you get passenger journey growth because it's back to the ease of access to the bus system, just as you get as Oyster in London. But ECRM is an integral part of what we do. I'm happy to try and hunt the figure out if you'd like. In terms of road congestion and people transferring modal shift, as we'd call it. I remember we've often talked about this in the past, about the push and pull factors that take place in terms of why people choose to go by car or whether they go by public transport. There is certainly, with a reduction in fuel prices at the moment, the people really relate to that marginal cost. They forget about depreciation costs or the insurance costs. They relate often to that marginal cost of travel. But then on the other side of the coin, of course, is that correct? You know, you've got a lot of congestion because our roads are very congested. Certainly, if you're in the southeast, it's a very congested network, and that puts people off. It certainly isn't going to change the dynamics of anybody commuting into London, in my opinion, because you've got heavily congested roads, you've got parking constraints, you've got congestion charging, etc., etc., etc. I don't see that changing the profile of it at all. And the more enlightened local authorities outside of London have also tried to introduce car restraint. Lots of discussions in places like Oxford about car restraint, lots of discussions in Brighton, that's part of the low emission zone that they've introduced. So there isn't a local authority we don't deal with that thinks about car constraint and how it can manage that. So in the end, you've got push and pull factors taking place all of the time. It is true that in London, the car usage is declining. That's partly because of all the things I've just expressed, and partly because there's good public transport provision as well in London. And some of that will flow out into the regions as well. An interesting statistic that came up, there's progressive movement of people having provisional licences as older teenagers and what have you. Actually, the facts of the matter is they only have provisional licences because it's a really good way of showing their age when they want to get into a nightclub. Hey, you know, and they presumably went there by bus, so that's fine. The Labour Party, we'll work with any administration whoever comes in. That's what we have to do, and we do believe we're adaptable enough to deal with that. In the end, somebody does have to run the transport, and we have the skill sets to be able to do that. The
How do we prepare for changes in transport policy? We consistently point out with facts what the truths are and what it delivers and what it can do. And we just are very consistent, whoever it is we're talking to, we just very consistently point out those facts. We've just produced, as an industry for railways, one of these magazines, booklets, it's not spin. It says these are the facts. They come from the DfT's own statistics. They come from the ORR's statistics. This is what's happening. It is the fastest growing railway in Europe at the moment. One of my partners from Keolis, I mean, we don't see it all the time, says, you know, you don't realise how lucky you are, which is sort of a strange expression sometimes, but they say, you know, you've got really good train services and you don't realise how much better they are than in Europe, because there's this myth that actually we're not better. So we'll just keep on applying the facts. And in the end, somebody does have to run the railways, somebody does have to run the buses. And we are adaptable to deal with that.
Gerald Koo from Liberum. A few questions for me. Going back to the GTR point, you talked about there being extra cost, a short-term, temporary shortfall in profit, but your guidance for this year is unchanged. Should I view that as there being a positive offset elsewhere? I suspect Southeastern. Secondly, can you just remind me on the net debt to EBITDA covenant? I was just looking at that chart. Is the covenant calculated on reported net debt, or is it net debt excluding the restricted cash? And finally, you flagged the bus bid costs relating to Singapore. Should we be expecting more going into next year? And presumably your target 100 target stands regardless.
Unfortunately, they're all my questions. Yeah, you're absolutely right. We've seen overperformance, or better than expected performance, in Southeastern. So we probably didn't expect to be in profit share almost as soon as we started the contract, helped by very positive revenue growth. As far as the cash is concerned, we outline, I think on the slide, on the balance sheet slide, on slide 11, I think, or 12, might even be 13, 14, how we calculated our adjusted net debt. So there's a table on the bottom right-hand corner, the fact that we add back restricted cash and how we come back to our adjusted net debt. So that's on that table there. Is that what you meant?
What's the covenant based on? You've got the line that's covenants at 3.5.
Oh, it's 3.5, sorry, yeah.
But that is that adjusted net debt to EBITDA?
Yes, oh yes, our bank covenant is based on adjusted net debt. Sorry, yes, I understand the question. And as far as bid costs are concerned, I mean, what we've said here is all we've committed to. So if that changes at some point in the future, we will let you know how that changes, and then we will let you know how, whether or not that impacts any target, whether that's bus or rail. But that, you know, that's currently all that we've committed to as a business.
Any other questions? Gone. Thank you very much yet again for your attention, for good questions. Enjoy the rest of the day. Thank you.